If you're shopping while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast, then you know and love the thrill of a deal. But are you getting the deal and cash back? Rakuten shoppers do. They get the brands they love, savings, and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores like Levi's, Plow & Hearth, Adidas, Sephora, and Neiman Marcus. Stack sales on top of cash back and feel what it's like to know you're maximizing the savings. And it's easy to use. And you get your cash back sent to you through PayPal or check. The idea is simple. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back. Download the free Rakuten app or go to Rakuten.com to start saving today. It's the most rewarding way to shop. That's R-A-K-U-T-E-N, Rakuten.com.
This is the story of the one. As a custodial supervisor at a high school, he knows that during cold and flu season, germs spread fast. It's why he partners with Grainger to stay fully stocked on the products and supplies he needs, from tissues to disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Also that he can help students, staff, and teachers stay healthy and focused. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Welcome to the 9th United We Stand podcast of the season. My name's Andy Mitten, and I'm delighted to welcome our guest today. It's the distinguished football writer, Brian Glanville. 81 years old, Brian, is that correct?
I'm afraid so.
And a member of Who's Who since when?
1974.
That means you have your birthday published in all the newspapers?
Well, not all of them. These are so-called posh papers. But never the Daily Telegraph, which has obviously had better sense and felt that I was beneath the load of salt on having to think about it. But it doesn't keep me awake at night.
I'm sure it doesn't. When did you start writing about football?
49. I left Charterhouse after the what we used to call the long court of the Easter term in 1949.
So 1949, my uncle Charlie Mitten, he would have been playing then. He would have been a big name in English football. I obviously knew him, but I never had the privilege of watching him play. Was he a good footballer?
He was an absolutely excellent footballer. He had beautiful balance. He had played a splendid left foot. As you know, he was a complex and sometimes curious character. After the whole Bogota episode in 1950 had apparently gone cold, and I'll remind you of that, but Neil Franklin, the very elegant England and Stoke City centre-half, suddenly, having told the FA and lied, said that his wife's having a baby and he couldn't play in the 50 World Cup in Brazil, flew out with the mounts of the outside right to Bogota, the capital of Colombia, to sign for Santa Fe.
Yes.
Because at those times they were outside people and they could play what they liked, and they were going to pay £50 a week, which is a fortune, then you had not climb up quite enough. So they flew out there, and others, like Bobby Flavel, the Scottish international, various others, all went out there. But they didn't stay very long. The whole thing foundered, and they came home rather with their tails between their legs, and Franklin had ruined his career, really. He ended up playing rather obscurely for Hull City. And suddenly your Uncle Charlie, after it was all over, suddenly he flew out to everybody's astonishment. And he played out there, made a lot of money, and apparently did quite a lot of horse dealing. And then eventually came home, had a suspension, which was not particularly burdensome, and then signed for Fulham. He had put on quite a lot of weight, so the speed had gone, but the left foot was there, and the shrewd football brain was there. And for some time, he played for Fulham and eventually became manager, as you know, Newcastle United. And I remember Ernie Clay, that old rogue who ran Fulham for quite a long time, saying to me he was about the only manager he knew who had what was known as a blower straight through to the bookie in his managerial office.
It doesn't surprise me. I used to go and see Charlie on a Sunday afternoon in Old Trafford, and there were more books and pictures around the house with greyhounds on than there were about football. But I'm told he was a wonderful player, definitely a character, and I use that in a diplomatic sense, because when he passed away 10 years ago, I researched his life quite deeply, and there's some quite uncomfortable moments. Charlie had continued to cash my great-grandmother's pension book, for example, after she'd passed away. But he was very popular within the family. He was great with my mum and dad, and he always spoke about taking penalty kicks. He scored 17 penalties for Manchester United, which was a record which stood until Eric Cantona was around, and he said, "You simply don't have an excuse for missing a penalty from 12 yards out."
You... A fair few players can be told be being accused of that. And I saw one of them on boot a penalty over the bar, Eagles. So he booted a penalty over the bar. Excellent United player at at Millwall when playing for Bolton. So it still happens.
Eagles was very promising for Manchester United, and you could see why he went to Bolton, and he had some good moments there. And suddenly he finds himself now playing at the wrong end of the Championship. His career's not worked out quite as he would have hoped for.
He had an extraordinary game there. He was one moment here, another a villain. The crowd got onto him because he'd obviously thrown himself a dive looking for a penalty which he didn't get. he had a tremendous shot just before half-time when against the run of play, which was well saved by the Millwall keeper. Later on, he drove a free kick through the wall, gave him a goal, but he also missed the penalty, and he got booked for a very unpleasant challenge very late in the game, so you might say he had quite an eventful afternoon.
Now, you started writing about Manchester United quite a lot in the 1950s, is that right?
That will be true. I mean, they were a fascinating club, and the great progenitor, of course, was Matt Busby. And I remember around about 52, I guess, before I went to live 3 years in Italy, talking to him at after a game at Chelsea about the Busby Babes and the youth scheme. He said, "Well, if you don't put rather cogently, if you don't put him in, you can't know what you've got." He did put him in, and what he'd got was remarkable. Although, of course, they're a very ruthless club, and they purloin players from all over the place who should really have played for other clubs. Bobby Charlton should have played for Newcastle. Poor old Duncan Edwards should have played for Wolves or West Brom Albion. He was born in Dudley in the West Midlands. But they and Chelsea were ruthless in exploiting the possibilities of snapping up young players who should have gone somewhere else.
And that was by having an extensive scouting network, or was that frowned upon?
That's right.
in those days?
Billy Rocker, I think, was a star scout, wasn't he?
Yes.
Yeah. Yes, and I mean, the whole Bobby Charlton story is actually a very interesting and controversial one, because both he and Jackie, both whom I know very, very well over the years, deny it. But I was very friendly with Jackie Milburn, who, of course, is a close relation of Bobby. I used to see him quite a bit when Newcastle came to London, the hotel, was it, whatever it was, the Royal Northern, was it the Great Northern behind King's Cross? And he told me once that everything was arranged for Bobby to join Newcastle United, and he was going to be given a job in the Kensley House, which was the headquarters of the local papers, then became Thompson Newspapers later. Everything was fixed. And then suddenly the news came through that he had joined Manchester United, and Jackie told me that Sissy, mother, who I think also later denied it completely, said, "What could we do? Jackie, she was, I think it's his cousin, they offered us £750. That's always been denied, but I can't see why Jackie Milburn should have concocted a fallacious story talking to what was then a pretty obscure young journalist.
What was Matt Busby like?
he was a very genial figure on the face of it. There was steel there, of course, you know, as Johnny Morris found when he got rid of it, when he stood up to Busby. He didn't encourage any kind of rebellion or opposition among his players. I thought he did an extraordinary job, because when he took over, I mean, Old Trafford, there's a famous picture of George Routon, a former United player, standing in the goal mouth, contemplating a tree which had grown there. As you know, it was years before United could even play at Old Trafford. They were sharing the Manchester City ground for years. I think Busby did an extraordinary job because he took over a team which was, wasn't in pieces, because quite a few of the pre-war side were still there. Players like Jack Rowley, Stan Pearson, Alan B. Chilton, who of course fought in London. I think even B-Day wasn't Alan B. Chilton, centre-half. John Carey, very important, who had been stationed in Italy and made quite a name for himself in Italian football at that time. They were there. But he brought in younger players with great success. And as I say, this sort of ruthless scouting organisation brought in players like Bobby Charlton and Duncan Edwards. And I think he was a very dominating figure. I think he wasn't all geniality. I mean, Frank O'Farrell found it quite impossible when Busby allegedly stepped down as manager. And Busby wouldn't even let him have his office, would he? Frank had to take an office across the corridor, and he found that he was completely overshadowed by Matt. Where he couldn't really succeed was in the case of somebody like George Best, who I also knew very well for many years, when he was 17. George was a very complex character, and it needed somebody with rather more psychological insight than someone who had come from a mining family and has played professional football and been a PE instructor during the war. He was too much for Busby, and I think he would have been too much for practically any manager. He needed very careful and expert handling, and he wasn't going to get it there.
Paddy Crerand, whose autobiography I worked on with him, said if George wouldn't have been good-looking, there would have been none of the problems.
Oh, well, Paddy is an absolutely delightful person. We're still extremely friendly. He's been a good chum of mine for donkey's years. And it was George who said, rather boastfully, if I'd been born ugly, you would never have heard of Pelé.
And you used to go up to Manchester and you'd meet the players and you'd have good access to them as a journalist.
Oh, those are very remote days, yes. You couldn't think of them happening now. Yes, I remember being taken out to lunch when I went out there by Paddy and various others. It was a very interesting time that wasn't very well known, that there were the two absolutely... really almost hostile cliques in that successful team. There were the Celts, you know, the Scots, the Irish, Welsh, etc. And there were the English. And it could be summed up by the time that George Best went into a pub, didn't he, where there was a great big painting of Bobby Charlton and he threw eggs at it.
Mm, mm.
And they were very much two different cliques, and there were those who tremendously admired Bobby Charlton and the English side, and there were those who tended slightly to disparage him, and their heroes were George Best and Dennis Law.
And yet those two cliques, those two opposites, managed to combine well and be very successful as a team,
yes,
on the pitch.
Yes, they did, and I'm certainly not prepared to take sides at all over
that.
Because I've known Bobby for donkey's years and very much appreciated his qualities. George, very funny, I don't know if you know, he's very amusing. I remember sitting behind him. This is something absolutely inconceivable today. On the Manchester United coach, for some reason passing through London, I was sitting just behind George, and he suddenly turned to me. Malcolm Allison was then the manager of Manchester City, you remember, very flamboyant, very outspoken, and George turned to me and said, they've made Malcolm Allison, the New England coach, they're putting the seats in his mouth.
Was it sad for you to see George's decline?
Well, it was terribly sad. It was horrible, really, because I'd known him when he was a very bright young kid, 17 or 18. And I even remember once being flown out to California to do an interview with him for a big program I was doing for ITV. And he was absolutely delightful and modest and incredibly friendly. And I was terribly sorry to see what happened, the descent into ill health, misery, alcoholism, terribly, terribly sad. But he was a marvellous player, and there's no doubt in my mind he's the best player ever played for Manchester United, and it was certainly since the war when I was watching football.
Yeah. You lived in Italy for 3 years, and you can still see the influence in your writing to this day. You mentioned that Johnny Carey, a great Manchester United player, left a mark on Italian football. I don't know anything about that. What's that
well,
about?
Well, I'm not quite sure which team he played for. He was known as Cario. C-A-R-I-O, And he played there, I suppose, towards the, just after the war. He was stationed there with his army unit and very much admired. I mean, he was a very important figure for... he was a sort of father figure of the team, wasn't he, for Matt? He
was
sort of... was Italian expression, in authority in campo, the manager on the field. He was the manager on the field. He was Busby's right hand. And when and Busby kept things... very simple, didn't he? I mean, oh, it's elaborate stuff now, and this absolute battery of various machines checking up on players, etc. All these rather convoluted technical, tactical theories. I mean, when they were down against Blackpool in the 48th final, his instructions at half-time were simply keep on playing football, and they did, and they won.
Yeah, and that was one of the great cup finals.
Yes. It was. They were down. You know, Schumer got a penalty, didn't he? And they came back and won it 4-2.
That's still the last time my grandparents went to London that day, because Charlie got them tickets and they took a coach down from Manchester. And my granddad, who was involved in Cherbourg just before D-Day, he's not been to London since.
Really?
And he was a professional footballer as well, but... It never took him to London.
Who did he play for?
He played in Northern Ireland for Ballymena professionally. And then, and then he played for Altrincham. And then he had 9 children, 6 of whom were boys, including my dad. And I think all the boys got paid to play football.
I assume he came from a Catholic family.
No.
He didn't?
No, he didn't.
That's remarkable, isn't it?
Yeah, I think Ballymena is... It was quite.
I was sort of Ballymena as a Protestant.
Yeah, absolutely.
Protestant bastion.
Yeah. No, the story is that my great grandfather was in the British Army. That's why.
Yes.
That's why Charlie was born in Rangoon. That's why my grandfather was born in Bombay. And my grandfather, if he does travel, obviously not to London, he still gets asked because his place of birth is Bombay, and that can cause him problems to this day. But Charlie's two sons were both played. John was a very good cricketer, first-class cricketer for Leicester. Charlie Jr. was at Manchester United and then Newcastle United and never quite made the first team. And then my own brother's at Stockport County. My other brother played semi-pro. So I'm like the black sheep of the family because I'm the only one who's never been paid to play football. But obviously I've enjoyed it, you know. There's no way I could not have enjoyed it. From the age of 3 or 4, I was taken everywhere watching my father play football. And then on a Sunday we'd go and see Charlie and he'd just regale us with these tales of Bogota and of Fulham and of Newcastle. And he lived in Old Trafford and he had a croquet lawn in his back garden, which I can assure you is not the norm in Old Trafford. How did Munich hit Manchester United? And you were around at the time. You were writing about it. What was it like?
Oh, very much so. It was just absolutely horrifying. I'll never forget that day. I'd been ghosting Jack Kelsey's autobiography, Wales and Arsenal goalkeeper, and we went into the publishers, and there was a little note in the stock press of one of the evening paper, I think the Old Star, that something had happened and Manchester United had had a problem with their aircraft, etc. But one didn't know the whole horror of it all. And it gradually came clear. I remember going out to do some training because I used to play for the little Sunday team that I co-founded, Chelsea Casuals. And we used to, my friend John Moynihan and I used to train on a Tuesday night, I think it was, whatever day it was, at QPR. And we found out about it then, and it was just horrifying to hear. And even then, I don't think we knew the full appalling dimensions of it. I still say that Busby shouldn't have taken off at that time. I mean, what's the point of saying it now? But if the plane failed twice to take off, surely the town could say, that's it, we're going to abort it, whatever it costs, that should have been done. And I still look back on the whole thing with horror.
Did you ever fly in one of those planes? I'm sure I remember reading you writing about those planes, saying they were unreliable, something like that.
I was told by somebody whom I used to work with, who'd been in the RAF, that it was a plane that had had difficulties at times getting off the ground anyway, that it wasn't entirely the full number. whatever. It was. I think that had something to do with it as well. We should never have tried to take off 50 kilos. Well, let's not talk about it now. I mean, it's a horror and it's over. I don't think it should ever have happened.
Manchester United rose from the ashes. They won the European Cup in 1968, and then went into decline in the 1970s and were relegated. What was that like as a period to cover the club? Because there was blight off the field with hooliganism, and yet the atmosphere at Old Trafford was famed for being really loud. And United had a national popularity, despite not having the best team by far.
Yes, well, my older boy, who's now an opera singer, he's got an Oxford Classics degree, etc., but he was football mad, and he followed them all over the place, and he used to travel the Cockney Reds at their most abrasive and sometimes violent, hoping they wouldn't. He said, "Dad, they hate those students, and I don't know what they'd do if they found out I was reading classics at Oxford." So at the end of every vacation, he'd say, "Cheerio, lads, won't see you for a while," and say, "What, going on holiday?" And he'd say, "No," and bow his head, and he said, "You're not," and he said, "They all think I'm going inside."
So rather than...
He went on travelling with them for quite a long time. Then he was up in Manchester after Oxford at the Royal Auckland College of Music for years. So he was able to walk down the road and see United then. But then he got so sick of what Roy Keane has characterised as the prawn cocktail syndrome that he started, when he's back in London, watching Millwall instead.
I think you would find that a lot of Manchester United fans would agree with him. That would be the commercialisation of football and the lack of the atmosphere, yeah, which probably attracted him in the first place. You've seen football through the ages. You've often been a critic of the Premier League for its greed.
Yeah, the greed is good league, I call it.
And yet people at the Premier League would boast that football's never been better. Attendances are very high, stadiums are superb. But I think the atmosphere is one thing that has really struggled and suffered. And when I watched the Borussia Dortmund fans in Manchester last week, I was actually envious that the German fans are so well organised and create such a din, and their clubs support their fan culture, and that just doesn't happen in Britain anymore.
No, I mean, the wells have been poisoned, and I hate what's happened to Manchester United, the people who've taken it over, these soulless people who are interested only in money. I think that's terrible. I mean, Ferguson seems to genuflect to them for his own good purposes, but I'm sure that inwardly he can't be very happy about it. I think that's terrible, the way it's been allowed to happen. And mind you, Martin Edwards was a curious figure. He with a very, very bizarre background. But he made huge sums of money out of the club, although a lot of it, he was swindled out of a lot of it, wasn't it? Obviously, and he had a rather strange, spotty sort of life after he'd given up. I won't go into that. He made a huge amount of money out of it. And when it has become, when it has ceased to become, to follow the pattern of British football and English football, in which nobody could make much money out of anything, but he made a lot. On the other hand, he, when everybody was dumping on Alex Ferguson, he saw him through it. And in the end, when they won, the turning point came when they won the Cup Winners' Cup. And I know my big lad Mark was there, dancing with all the members of Manchester United fans. His son turned into... No, wait a minute. No, his brother turned into a very good footballer. That was the best footballer in my family. Toby, he played pro in Italy. Yeah. The third division club when he was 17, taken up by the man who discovered the star of the 1990 World Cup, Bruno Conti, but gave up eventually after a bad experience in America, and he's now in Naples as an international photographer.
Wow. Martin Edwards, he did make a lot of money. He also lost the money in a swindle. He still goes to every game, and he still buys all my books and rings me up if he finds a mistake. And so,
well, then he'll get his day out of hell. like the soldier in the epilogue of Bernard Shaw's St. Bert Journey. He gets one day out of hell a year because he gave a cross to the maid as she was burning at the stake.
Yeah. The Glazers you touched on, that should never have been allowed to happen, should it? A highly leveraged buyout using the money of supporters to pay the debts which they've inflicted on the club.
Oh, don't talk to me about it. The whole system, there's an evil odour about it. I don't think they like it. I mean, they talk about the success of the Premiership. Is at the expense of the fans who made football, that's the working class fans. They've been priced out of it, which I think is utterly shocking.
Yeah.
You know, they were the warp and woof, the very basis of professional football in this country. And even middle class people and middle class youngsters can't afford to go to the blinking games. Mm. It's outrageous. Mm. And prices go up and up and up. No, it's all wrong. And the football's not that good, because once it confronts the better European sides, and what happens to it? Look at Manchester City. Some of their football this season, Europe's been an absolute disgrace. I can't stand the sort of money that's gone to Manchester City and Chelsea. I still say, when I called it the Breeders' Good League when it was founded, and that's what I jolly well call it still.
Yeah. Why does Sir Alex Ferguson stick up for the Glazers? That frustrates a lot of Manchester United fans, who hold him in the highest esteem. He's enriched their lives greatly. They think he's a wonderful football manager. They just cannot understand why he says that the Glazers are good. I've spoke to various people about this, and one of them said, well, to Ferguson, they probably are good, because they give him ultimate power. They never question what he does, and he's probably not had that in his career up to this point.
I think he's a shrewd man who paddles his own canoe. You know, he feels it. So I can't imagine that he finds him very endearing or interesting or particularly sympathetic. But it suits him to say what he does, because he can get what apparently he wants. And you know, there's an awful Italian expression, Sicilian expression, una mano lava l'altra, one hand washes the other.
Yeah,
and it suits him to keep him with him. I don't find it very endearing. I mean, I don't find him very endearing. I mean, I admire him of what he's done as a manager, but there are lots of things that he's done that which I won't go into now, which I haven't found very impressive or very sympathetic. But nobody can deny his extraordinary achievements, and I don't.
Is he the greatest ever British manager?
I would have thought Herbert Chapman, who revolutionised football with Charlie Buckham, the great captain and inside forward, and when he invented Charlie invented the W formation of the third back game, he revolutionised Arsenal and in many ways revolutionised football.
But you're an Arsenal fan. Is there a slight bias there?
I was. I was about 21. I decided I'd become neutral. But I've written books, history books about the Arsenal. I wrote the official book about the Arsenal Stadium history. But they've had their ups and downs as well. I sometimes used to say that I've fallen out with the more Arsenal managers than you've had hot dinners.
Uncle Charlie supported Arsenal as a kid. His dream wasn't to play for Manchester United when he was growing up in Scotland, because that's where my great-granddad was based,
right,
at Dunblane. But Herbert Chapman's Arsenal, that was his dream. And
okay.
And he was an Arsenal fan as a kid, but obviously went to Manchester and things worked out well for him there. What do you make of the current Manchester United team?
A little bit fragile. I mean, lots of talent in it. Dazzling talent up front. In fact, too much of it.
Yeah.
Holding everyone at his feet. Not entirely effective in midfield, and without Vidic, somewhat vulnerable in defence. I mean, I don't see that this is the so-called Premier League is paramount. I mean, it's great until they start playing the better European clubs, and then we see their deficiencies.
Mm. How does a visit to Old Trafford now compare to in days gone by for you?
How does
a visit to Old Trafford compare?
I go there very seldom now.
Yeah.
Well, it's never the same when you don't know the players.
Yeah.
I hardly ever speak to a player now. And in the old days, they were all one's friends, they visit one's house.
Yeah.
Then days is gone, I'm afraid.
So you used to go up there, you'd watch a game, you'd go out with the players socially as well as speaking to them.
Well, not at that time, not at the same time, because I'd be working. But, you know, I'd go out there to do a story, and then I'd be with them and have lunch with them, etc., which they kindly bought for me.
Yeah.
Those days is gone.
What was Duncan Edwards like?
Not the same. I'm sorry for younger journalists now. They don't have an easy time from that point of view. Ferguson, by the way, is always in a slightly paranoid way kicking journalists out of his press conferences. It's become a sort of major question now the Football Awareness Association, such as it is, are trying to intervene because he keeps kicking people out of his press conference. It's ridiculous.
Those people are doing their jobs. They're reporting team news. The media have reported team news at Manchester United since the club were founded as Newton Heath in 1878. One of the less edifying aspects of Sir Alex Ferguson's personality that he does that.
Well, there are a number of aspects, but I'm not going to go into them now. There are stories that I know and things that United have arm strokes they try to pull. But I don't really want to illustrate them now.
And yet, he keeps proving people wrong. He keeps rebuilding very, very good Manchester United sides. He's done it 4 or 5 times now. He's written off critics even close to home. And he's in the job after nearly 26 years at Old Trafford. That's incredible.
It's incredible, it's astonishing, it's thoroughly praiseworthy. I don't deny that for a moment. Give him his due, he's been a remarkable manager.
What was Duncan Edwards like as a player? He's a revered figure among United supporters.
Duncan Edwards was an extraordinarily powerful player, an enormously influential player with a wonderful left foot, the perfect left half. One of the outstanding players of his generation. And the way he died was, I think, just too shocking for words. Mm-hmm. And the deep irony being, as I suggested earlier, really he should never have joined Manchester United at all. He should have joined probably Wolves. Mm-hmm. And then it would never have happened. But what's the point of speculating on the only?
What's the greatest ever English side?
I would think probably the one we had in the war. So the results didn't really matter. You know, it was Britton Cullis Mercer, half-back line, Matthews, the idol of all schoolboys. Mm-hmm. It was Matthews, Carter, Lawton, Hagen, and Dennis Compton, another of my idols, cricketer and footballer. Yeah. But who knows? I mean, it's such a subjective matter. You can't compare teams because football changes radically.
Who've been your favourite club sides in of all the ones that you've seen?
Well, as an Arsenal fan, you know, when I was an Arsenal fan, Arsenal was a side I liked, and Arsenal was a side I followed. But it's hard. I mean, I think United teams, several United teams, have been among the best to watch, unquestionably.
Yeah.
Liverpool, I've never been entirely convinced by Liverpool. They had all those successes in the European Cup, but I didn't think the standard was that good then.
Yeah. Are you optimistic about the future of football in England?
Not really.
Why?
Because I think money talks and money shouts, and even though new European rules are coming in to try and limit the power of money, they won't succeed in doing so. And I think football has been undermined by the existences of finance, the degradations of finance. You know, things will go on, but it'll go on at the expense of the people who really are the life and the historic support of football, and that's the working classes.
Yeah, a lot of people listening to this will agree with that. They've become completely disenfranchised with modern-day football. They probably don't go to as many games as they used to go to. Finally, who is the greatest player, Brian, that you've ever seen? You've seen countless thousands of football matches. If you had to pick one who stands out.
I would think it had to be Pelé, wasn't it? I covered 13 World Cups, 12 for the Sunday Times, one for the People. And I covered all his World Cups. And I thought he was an amazing player at 17, you know, with a hat-trick in the semi-final against France in 58, Sweden. And then the wonderful goals that he scored in the final in 58. Then, of course, he had problems with injuries, etc. But he came right back and was superb in the 1970 World Cup as well. And the number two would be Alfredo Di Stefano, or Stefano, if you pronounce it the Spanish way.
Yeah.
Super versatile centre forward for Real Madrid, who was playing total football before anybody else had even thought of inventing it.
Yeah.
Those are my two greatest. And I suppose the player, the hero of my generation, a very young boyhood fans, would be Stanley Matthews. I thought he was wonderful, and I had the great pleasure and privilege of actually stood lunch by him the day he went back to Stoke City from Blackpool, and I came to them quite well later on, but he was an absolutely magical player, and I'll never forget watching him. When he came down to play in London for Blackpool, it was always reckoned he'd put $10,000 on the game, but even he couldn't stop Manchester United being able to.
We've spoken about some of the older Manchester United players. What about the newer generations? Eric Cantona, Brian Robson, Roy Keane, Ryan Giggs, Paul Scholes, all hugely popular.
Players. I remember being introduced to Ryan Giggs when he was 16 years old by Joe Brown, whom I knew very well from his early days. He was the chief scout. I was coming across the forecourt leading a match, and he and the relative introduced me. He said, this is Ryan, and why didn't he get me? But I remember later Ryan Giggs, who's 16. Very bad footballer, my goodness, he has been too.
Yeah, and what about the others?
Cantona was a magnificent player, very fine biography, which I suggest, by Philippe Auclair, my French friend, written in beautiful English. Wonderful talent, but he had a cloven hoof, didn't he? And that cloven hoof descended all too often on a hapless opponent. But a great player, under there.
Scholes?
So many.
Paul Scholes, finally?
I admired him from very early ages, I thought supremely versatile player, and never quite did what one would have expected for England. Probably Paul Scholes was never a violent player, but he constantly seemed to go into tackle self-defense off. But a remarkable player with an amazing career and astonishing stamina. Yes, a great footballer indeed.
Finally, predict who will win the Premier League, the Greed League, as you call it, this year, and the European Cup, or the Champions League, as it's now called now.
Well, either Barcelona or Real will win the European Cup. The league? I'll say Manchester United, because I'd just be much happier, you know. I mean, a little bit, given their owners, it's a little bit nice asking, are you going to be shot or hanged? But I don't want City to buy it again. They just bought it last season, I thought, in extremely dubious circumstances. Good God. A very late extra time winning goal against a 10-9 Queen's Park Rangers team. Oh, please. The defence rests.
Thank you for your time, and all the best of luck for the future.
Thank you, and to you. Bye.
Bye-bye. So that's it for the United We Stand podcast for this week. Apologies about the sound in the last couple of minutes there with Brian Glanville. We'll be back next week with another interesting guest. In the meantime, we're working on issue 221 of United We Stand, which comes out for the Stoke game at Old Trafford on the 20th of October. If you're not at the match and buying one outside the ground for £2, then you can subscribe by going to the website uwsonline.com. We can either post you a copy out, or you can now subscribe and get a digital edition for your PC, iPad, Mac, Android, whatever you want. We're getting a lot of subscribers around the world doing it that way. Until next week, goodbye.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.